Hello. Hello, my name is Victoria and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Let's start this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to may recover wish to may recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. If you have any concerns about safety or meetings, please message the host privately. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety card and safety in AA. Our common welfare. In an effort to lessen distractions and to respect our speakers, you will not be able to unmute yourself during the meeting. For everyone's safety, we ask that you use your first name and last initial. The chat is disabled until the end of the meeting, when we will also invite everyone to unmute and stay for online fellowship. To be on our email list, please email us at beacongroup164@gmail.com with your name, phone number, and sober date. At beacongroupaa.com, and we will help you get signed up. And now Sarah T will read the steps. Sarah, will you please unmute yourself?
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admit that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for our knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all of our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Jenny T. Jenny, you may unmute yourself.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to see everybody. Let me just switch this to the gallery view so I can feel like I'm not looking at myself the whole time. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. I can see some of my friends, some old friends, and some of my friends from Area 30 Service, and I want to thank Sue for asking me to speak. And I want to say thank you for having me back, because I spoke here a couple years ago, and I can tell you that people weren't asking me to come back before I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, so it's a privilege. Let's see here. I I think it's important to tell you what it was like so that you can identify with how I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I was born in Santa Monica, California in 1964 to parents who had had it really hard growing up. They were committed to giving their kids everything that they didn't have growing up. And they gave us a lot. They gave us a lot of opportunities. They gave us good education, all those types of things. But because neither of them had any type of recovery, they also passed along the family disease of alcoholism. So before I ever picked up a drink, I was learning the patterns of thinking that come with alcoholism. And, you know, some people say that they were an alcoholic before they picked up a drink, and that was certainly the case for me. However, I didn't wait that long to pick up my first drink. My first drunk was in fifth grade. I drank, me and my friends got three big glasses of Manischewitz wine. I drank all mine, and I drank most of hers, and I drank most of hers. Spent the rest of the night drunk and getting sick in the bathroom. And what's really important about that experience is not that that was, that drinking was not the pattern that established my behavior for the rest of my drinking career, but rather what happened the next day, which was, I'm never going to drink Manischewitz again. It never occurred to me to not drink again. It occurred to me to start to control and enjoy my drinking. And that was my drinking career until the very end. I spent a lot of time and energy at that, which meant that I didn't have a lot of time and energy for a lot of other stuff. I was one of those kids that they said, Jenny, if you would just apply yourself, you could go so far. I didn't know what that meant, but in fact, I did. I applied myself to trying to control and enjoy my drinking, you know, and I loved everything about alcohol. I didn't like the problems that came with it over time, but it gave me a sense of well-being. You know, when I was drinking, the past went away and the future didn't exist, and it was just right here, right now, and everything was good, you know. So I was willing to go to any length to get that. So my drinking career never got any better than that. My controlling and enjoying it became paramount, and the problems really piled up. In the last few weeks of my drinking, I had an ulcerated esophagus. I had a warrant out for my arrest. I had more bounce checks than I could imagine. And I had an uncashed paycheck in my purse. You know, I just had a lot of problems going on, and they seemed insurmountable. And the last night of my drinking was not intended to be the last night of my drinking. It was just the night when a series of things happened that I caused it. Happened that I swore I would never do. I swore would never happen. And they all just came in at the same time. And when I came to the next day, it's a longer story than that, obviously. But, you know, a couple days later, I realized I thought I was completely out of options. I was familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want anything to do with it. It was, you know, it was goofy, it was corny, it was religious, it was, you know, brainwashing, all those types of things. I wanted nothing to do with it. But at that precise moment, for some reason, I thought I was out of options. And so I was willing to go to AA. You know, it ends up that there were other options, insanity, death, and institutions. And I'm grateful that I didn't realize that those were choices. And I thought my only choice was to go to AA. And I didn't like it. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But something happened when I stood up for the first time and said, my name is Jennifer and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it ends up like that probably was the first time I had been honest since I had been conscious, you know, because I lied from the very beginning, always, you know, to get you off my back, to tell you what I thought you wanted to hear, to make things the way I wanted them to be, you know. So from that moment on, I realized that by going to AA, and admitting I was out of solutions and that AA was probably the only place for me, I had committed my first three steps. I did them more formally later on with a sponsor. But for me, that was the beginning. And I was all in. You know, for some reason, at that precise moment, I was all in. And, you know, I will share with you this, you know, that I'm, you know, I came into AA with no self-discipline, no skills. I was just barely getting by at a day job. I had dropped out of multiple community colleges because I couldn't hack it and all this type of stuff. And I thought, I don't know how I'm going to make it. I don't know what's going to happen. And they said, it's just one day at a time. You know, you're just going to do it one day at a time. And Another thing that was really powerful for me was this idea of getting into service right away. You know, and I know you guys have a lot of service jobs at this meeting, and it's something I really admire about you because it gave me a purpose and it gave me a sense of well-being that I really needed. You know, whether it was setting up the chairs, doing the coffee, you know, whatever it is, I felt a part of and I felt like I was adding value to the world for the first time. And that made me feel good. You know, before I got sober, the only thing that I thought was going to make me feel good was if I got my way, I got my stuff, and you behaved the way I wanted you to, you know, but it ends up that those aren't the things that actually give me a sense of well-being. It's all the little stuff and the big stuff that we've learned in that we can learn in AA, you know. And, you know, as I said, I didn't have any self-discipline or skills or whatever, but there's a speaker that I used to hear a lot where I got sober in Los Angeles, and he said that when a jet lands a plane, they don't hit the brakes, they reverse the engines. If you just use that same power that you use to get the drink toward your sobriety and your recovery, you have it made. That was the first time that I had realized that I actually had self-discipline and skills and energy and stick-to-itiveness and enthusiasm, because I've been using them for drinking all that time. I just needed to put it in a different direction. And that's what I've been doing now for a really long time, you know. And the details change in my recovery, but the principles don't. You know, the three legacies of unity, recovery, and service, they all go hand in hand. It's been told to me they're like a three-legged stool, and I need to have them all balanced. And when I go out of balance, just focusing on the 12 steps or just focusing on going to meetings or only focusing on service, I'm out of balance, you know? And so I always have the chance to get recalibrated, and I'm always rebalancing. The last year and a half, especially as we moved to virtual meetings, my service and my program got really intense, just like a lot of us. Some of us got really scared of it, actually, and really backed away from the online community. And I understand that, and I'm sad about it. But for me, it was to throw myself into that level of service. And I've had to sort of back out and rotate and let other people take jobs and focus more on my recovery. Oh, there's always, you know, my sponsor said to me a long time ago, there's different types of service for different types of people for different times in their recovery. And for me, that has really been true. I've done, you know, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous exactly as they're laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like you have. You know, it ends up that there's a million ways to read a book, you know, and I'm always learning new ways to do that. You know, that's the greatest part of the book. I've heard that's why it's a spiritual text. It's different every time I read it, you know, and I'm grateful for that. And for me, I'll tell you, I'll start to close with this idea is that, you know, as I mentioned before, the main reason why I drank was for that sense of well-being that came. You know, the idea that the past is going to make me cry, but the idea that the past is gone and the future doesn't matter, it's just right here, right now. That's what I was looking for in the alcohol. And that's what I get in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the steps have helped me clear away the wreckage of the past, and the future doesn't matter because I'm just right here, right now with you guys, you know? And, as long as I keep coming back and plug away at the same principles that were taught to me those first few days and few weeks and months in AA, I'm going to be okay. And in fact, I am okay right now. And so, you know, I'm on a pink cloud. I've been on a pink cloud for a long time. I got sober in January 13th, 1989, you know. And like I said, there's been highs and lows. There's been major losses. There's been major victories. And I can't believe my Zoom just went out. So I think we'll close. I hope you guys can still hear me as I close this out. I just want to say thank you so much for having me. And I'm grateful to be here with you guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Jenny. AA has no dues or fees for AA membership, but we do have expenses. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. We are observing the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. You should see a link on your screen, and we encourage you to support AA. Please take a moment to make a contribution if you can. Although we are meeting virtually, AA still has expenses. In fact, since the start of COVID-19, GSO has withdrawn approximately $4.5 million from the reserve fund. AA's usual suggestion is a $2 contribution per meeting. Please give what you can. If you do not have a Venmo account, but you would like to send a contribution through the mail, please message the host and they will supply our address. Thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. And now we have a special announcement from Christina.
Hi, Christina Alcoholic. I am here to remind you all and announce that we are having a business meeting after tonight's meeting, so immediately following the closing prayer. It is not our usual business meeting. It's an emergency one because we want all home group members to stick around, and we want to get your feedback on. We have two venue options for going back to meet in person, one in Back Bay, Boston, and one in Newton Center. And so we want to get the group's feedback, and one of them involves changing the night that we meet as well. So please stick around if you're a home group member or if you're someone who comes to this meeting regularly and, you know, plans to come in person. We want your feedback and to help us make a decision because we'd like to get back to meeting in person as soon as possible. So that will happen tonight, immediately following the business meeting or this meeting. Don't sign off. Stick around and we'll share some more info with you and hear your feedback. That's all. Thanks.
Tonight, Mike has been asked to read the 12 traditions. Mike, can you please unmute yourself?
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thanks.
Thank you. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Ryan M.
Hey guys, I'm Ryan, I'm an alcoholic. I'm also gonna change my view so I'm not looking at myself the whole time. I don't know if Brian's here, but I'd like to thank Brian for asking me to speak. I'll briefly qualify with my experience. I got sober in May of 2014. I was 21 when I got sober. It was not the first time I tried to get sober. I had been trying to get sober either for myself or for other people since I was like 18. I was like a quiet and uncomfortable kid when I was growing up. I was just shy. And then as I got older, it kind of turned into anxiety. The more I was conscious of it, the more uncomfortable I was. So I figured out a way to not be conscious of it through drugs and alcohol when I was like 12 or 13. And I loved it. It was great. I was hanging out with a lot of kids that were a little older than me because I had older brothers, but everyone my age didn't seem to be as into drinking at that time, which I couldn't understand. I still kind of don't understand, but I was hanging out with older people, and it started like, you know, just every weekend or every couple weeks, but I just wanted to do it as much as possible because I didn't have to feel nervous. I didn't have to feel uncomfortable or worry about what other people were thinking of me if I was drunk. So that just naturally progressed. But the funny thing is, like, the more that I did it, the more uncomfortable I felt when I wasn't under the influence of anything. So it's just like a vicious cycle. So that was when I was pretty young. And then, I don't know, it just progressed naturally as I got older. And then some life events happened. I talk about it a lot in my story because it's like the biggest part of my story. My mom died when I was 16 from cancer. She was sick for a while, but I didn't really know what cancer really was when I was younger, when she was sick. Then when she passed away when I was 16, I had already been drinking and doing other stuff, but it was a really good excuse to just like go off the rails and not have to try to answer to anybody and just not really have to try to live life anymore. Just try to blot out all the pain and uncomfortable feelings that came along with that. So I ran with that for quite a while. I started failing in school, and my main focus was to just escape how I was feeling. And it worked for a little bit, I guess. And then when I was 17, going on 18, I think I had already been kicked out of school. But I ended up going back into my school looking for my friend who is sober in AA now too. And my principal at the time was like, "Ryan, you have to go to the hospital or I'm calling the police." So I went to the hospital. That was my first experience going to detox at like 18. And it was like a dual diagnosis unit. It was a very interesting experience. That was my first, that wasn't my last. From 18 to 21, I was in and out of detox, in between 15 to 20 times, I think. In the end, when I finally got sober this time, I was homeless. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, but I was homeless in the city. I had nobody, literally nobody around me. Nobody wanted to be around me. I remember one time trying to call my brother. It was raining and it was cold out and he was sober at the time. And I was like, "Hey, Andrew, like, I need to stay at your house. Like, it's really cold and I'm scared and I can't sleep outside." And he's like, "Dude, I love you, but you can't stay with me." And like that was one of the last nights that I was out there. And it might not sound very impactful, but it had such an impact on me even now, just thinking back on it, because I could call my brother right now and ask him for literally anything and he would do it, you know, with no questions asked. But I was just such a liability at that time to everybody in my life that he just couldn't do it, you know. And my brother was sober in AA at the time, and I understand now why he couldn't do it. And he's a big reason why I was able to see the solution firsthand in my life, because he used to drink hand sanitizer. He used to, like, you know, he was the alcoholic, not me. And he got sober, you know? So then I convinced myself that I was bad enough. And I followed in his steps, his path kind of to lead me to you guys. And that's kind of where I'll stop with my past experience as far as drinking goes. But as far as recovery, you know, I had tried many times to get sober, and I didn't take any suggestions because I was really uncomfortable. Like, I'm still you know, I'm still a fearful, uncomfortable person at my core. So like, I didn't want to go to meetings and talk to you guys or look at anyone in the eyes, or just like, I didn't know how to conduct myself as a person. So why would I want to do that stuff? But you know, I was faced with life or death at this point, and I would die if I didn't find out a way to like get sober and live. So I just got uncomfortable. I went to meetings. I forced myself to talk to people, and that saved my life. And, you know, now I can go to meetings and be comfortable, you know, helping other people and talking to friends. But I just try to set aside my prejudice against anything, you know, against a higher power. I didn't think a higher power had anything to do in my life. That's for sure. But I just started praying. I got my sponsor. He gave me these suggestions. You know, I read the big book with him, started praying, like went to meetings, got a position at meetings, got involved and just like did stuff that I really didn't want to do. And it changed my life. I know for a fact I'd be dead if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and the big book and sponsor and all that good stuff that you hear people talk about. My time's running out really fast. I like my life today is just insane. I like speaking at meetings because I like trying to be helpful to other people. But what it also does for me is it shows me how different my life looks now. You know, I was homeless 7 years ago, begging people for change. And now I'm like, now I am sitting in my condo and like, I work talking to people about their investments and like stuff like that. It's very ironic to me. It's unbelievable, really, if I think about it. And I don't say that to like, you know, toot my own horn or anything like that. I really don't care about anything like that. But, you know, like I just got married. I live in a stable place, like stable house. I have a car. Like that's just these things that I shouldn't have lived to get to have, you know, with the way that my life was going and the things that I was doing. But I think the most important thing in my life, and the previous speaker touched on this as well, and I'll just kind of say it in my own words, I guess, is just that feeling that I know that no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay. Like, I'm still full of fear all the time, but I have a faith now in some kind of higher power that everything's going to be okay. And like, I don't have an obsession over drugs and alcohol that runs my life to the ground that's going to kill me. That's not there anymore. And it's because of the work that I've done and you know, the path that's been laid out for me and my higher power. But that obsession ran my life, and I couldn't do anything with that still in my mind, you know. So with that removed and that kind of path clear, now my life can grow so much and I can help other people to try to get to that point as well, and hopefully save some people from themselves, you know. Not that I'm saving anybody, but if it wasn't for somebody like my sponsor George that I could relate with, I'd probably be dead if he didn't take the time to talk to me, you know. So I just want to say my last few seconds, I'm available to talk to. I'm available for sponsorship. I'm available for anything that anyone in this room or AA needs, because I know how uncomfortable it can be to be new, and it's life or death. You know, we all know a lot of people are dying from this from various ways, but I'm here to help. So thanks.
Thank you, Ryan. We encourage you to sign up on our website for updates on our online meetings and to let us know there if you would like to do service for any of them. We also encourage you to stay online after the meeting to make yourself available to and exchange information with newcomers. And now please welcome our main speaker, Stephanie K.R.
Hey. Thank you, Victoria. I'm an alcoholic and my name is Stephanie. Hi. I'm on my iPad and I don't know. Thank you for turning your camera on, Suzanne. And I don't know how to make people. Usually I can drag people around, but this is who I'm going to get to look at. So thank you for asking me to do this. I always, like Ryan was saying, I always like to be of service. It's an honor. because, you know, like Jane said, people weren't asking me, they weren't even asking me to stick around, let alone come back, right? It was just kind of like, So I only have a half an hour, which, as anyone who knows me knows, is like definitely not enough time to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll be really brief with the drunkalogue part. I want you just to imagine a dumpster fire. And then I want to imagine a woman running from the dumpster fire with her hair on fire, with some sort of weapon or like a hammer or something over her head in one hand, and in the other hand, a bottle of vodka, running, screaming, "Tell me you love me." And that basically encapsulates my drinking. That is exactly what my drinking looked like. It was a hot, I was a hot mess, and I also, I'm going to tell you the story because I love to tell the story. This was like one of the very first times I drank. I'm from Boston. I got sober, actually. I went to a lot of meetings in the Back Bay. I was going to Emerson when I got sober. But I grew up in Winchester, and my mother found Al-Anon. And my father was an active alcoholic while I was growing up for a long time. And my mother and all her little friends went to an Al-Anon convention, and they left us home with the drunk dads. And so I was going to find out what alcohol was all about. And I had drank before this. I had definitely been drunk before this, but this was like my first, like, I'm going to get drunk moment, like on purpose. And evidently, like, social drinkers have other activities that is actually the focus of what they're doing, and alcohol just kind of is sprinkled on it. For me, alcohol always was the activity. Like, it was the point. But so this night I went out with this girl, Sharon, and I was like in seventh grade. So I was tiny. I was a little person, young, so young. I see my friends, or I saw my kids when they were that young. Absolutely. I should not have been doing what I was doing, but, we went out and we were going to find out what this thing alcohol was all about. And we went up to Sharon's house, and we went into her parents' liquor cabinet, and we took out a blender, and we put in just a shot of everything that was in the liquor cabinet, because you can't get caught, right? So it had, we had all the schnapps, all the lime, I can remember lime liqueur going down the outside of the blender, like green. It's thick. We added like brandy, all the mixers as well, because I don't know what's alcoholic and what's not. I was definitely one of those kind of people. And we added 2 scoops of Nestle's Quick, and then we mixed it up, right? And Nestle's Quick doesn't actually dissolve in alcohol. And so it was literally this brown liquid with this brown powder on top. But here's the thing, and this is how I know that you're my people. Like, your vibe attracts your tribe. So, hey, welcome. If you laugh at all in the next 15, 20 minutes, then you might be where you're supposed to be. But like, for me, what happens when I drink alcohol, I believe real alcoholics like us, we have like this alcohol chakra at the core of our being. And when I drank that blender, right, like I could feel the Nestle's Quick in my teeth because it did not dissolve, but I was not drinking for the taste, right? They drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Hey, that would be me. I love the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I don't know about you all, but and this is how I know that alcoholism is not only a physical disease, but for me, as soon as I had the bottle in my possession, I felt that sense of ease and comfort. I didn't even have to have it in me yet. As soon as that bottle was on the car seat beside me, I felt okay. I could breathe, you know? And that night when we drank that blender full of brownness, you know, that booze hit that alcohol chakra. And so suddenly, you know, like happens with us, anything is a good idea. You know, you say to me when I'm drinking, "Stephanie, do you want it?" And I'm like, "Yes." You don't even have to finish the sentence. That is not safe behavior for a young woman. Okay. It's not safe behavior for anyone, but particularly for me, running around in my little Z Cavarici jeans with a side ponytail, thinking I was all that and a bag of Doritos. Do you know what I mean? So we drank that blender full of stuff and that alcohol chakra was enacted and like activated or whatever. And like, for me, I felt like enough, you know, when I had just enough booze hit my core of my being, I could suddenly stand up straight. My shoulders came back. I could breathe all the way in. Like I could inhale and mean it. I felt like I could talk to people. I was charming. I was beautiful. I looked like Cindy Crawford and I could dance like Janet Jackson. You literally either wanted to be me or be with me. And I thought, like, in my head, there was theme music everywhere I went. It was a grand old time. Like the big book says, I had arrived. I had arrived, you know? But the problem is, and what the big book also tells me is that once I start drinking, I have little control over the amount that I take or my ability to stop. Right. And so what happens is I start by drinking and I end up by drinking. Like I drink until I am physically incapacitated, until I cannot get it in me. And if you're going to give me outside substances or issues or whatever, that's going to enable me to drink vodka like it's water for 3 days. Yes, I am going to take that. And I'm going to hide my vodka and drink your vodka in the meanwhile, because that's how I roll, you know? And so for me, alcoholism has always been this disease of perception, my inability to see the truth, right? I can't see that it's actually that alcohol is the problem. It's everything else. And my alcoholism makes it so that the biggest lie my alcoholism tells me is that there's not enough, you know, or that my solution is out here. And so what happened for me after I drank that blender full of yumminess was that, you know, my alcoholism was activated and I kept drinking and trying to feel okay. And the problem was that I had no control over the amount that I took once I started. And so I would do things that I was ashamed of and embarrassed of. And I couldn't understand why, you know? And I would like pick out cigarette butts from drinks and drink them at the end of the night. Like I cannot pretend that I drank too much wine and spilled some cheese or whatever in my drinking. Like it was gross. I puked on people. You know, I jumped out of moving vehicles. Like I cannot romanticize the drink. And so obviously I'm qualified to be here, right? I only have 22 minutes. So here we go. So eventually there was a dude, there's always a dude, right? Eventually there's a dude and I am in this place of drinking all the time and I can't deal with my own feelings. I can't identify my own feelings because I've been raised, right? My defense mechanisms, I've been raised to, first of all, I have an alcoholic father, to absolutely be able to sense exactly what's going on around me and to try to predict the feelings of people, right? And my thing is that I do what I think you want me to do, not what you tell me to do, right? And this is the twistiness of my alcoholism. And what that means is I will say to someone, and I can still do it in romantic relationships, hence there is not one right now. But what I will do is this person will say to me, Stephanie, you're wonderful. I love you. And I will think to myself, no, that can't be true. That can't be true. It would be better. They would like me more. They would love me more if I was thinner, if I was faster, if I was fancier, if I was funnier, if I was taller. I have no idea. It's always what I think they want me to be. And so my whole drinking career and much into my sobriety has been this chameleon act. You know, I try to be who I think you want me to be. Think as a, instead of doing the feel, right? Instead of doing the feel. Because what the big book also tells me is that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, right? And what happens for me because of my drinking is I get separated from my God. And I believe that we all have this little spark, right? And this little spark is our little God and it just shines. And when you talk, when I talk to another person, like it shines a little brighter. And when I do good things and I speak my truth and I honor my highest self by following my dreams and aspirations, it shines a little brighter, right? It always shines a little brighter. But what happened in my alcoholism was that these little nesting dolls and these walls and the cement would get built up around it because I was afraid and because I had learned that when you show people who you really are, they then use it against you. And that's what I did. I amassed information and I was a master at it. You know, I amassed information and then I would deploy it at strategically the appropriate moment for maximum impact, right? That's not who I want to be today at all. But that's who I was. And so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've said that like four times and we're still not in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a dude, and I had told him, you're an alcoholic, you need help. And he was like, screw you. And eventually, you know, we ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was there for support. I was there for support, which obviously, as from the dumpster fire, as my drinking episodes illustrate, I do not need to be here for support. I need support, man. And so, you know, I was that girl at the meetings. I was like draped over him, my hand literally in his crotch. So all you women would back off because I knew how women alcoholics must be, you know, and this is my man. And I was like, yeah, I'm here for support. And the women here told me to keep coming back. And the women here, see, this is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous did not run up to me and say, girl, you reek of alcohol. Girl, you need to be sober, or he's not the problem, you are. They didn't say any of those things to me. All of those things would have been warranted. Instead, they said to me, we're glad you're here. Keep coming back. And my ego and my God, see, I believe that God keeps us sheltered from that which we cannot handle. And so my God has been remarkable in her shell game, you know, in terms of keeping me in blind ignorance for a long time about certain things, because that's what I need. You know, I don't think I ever would have walked into Alcoholics Anonymous for myself, but I walked in here for Joe. And because of Joe, I read that book and I was going to get Joe well, because I believed that if Joe got well, I could be okay. You know, and I think it was the first speaker that was also talking about that, you know, like I can still, even in sobriety, be that place that like, well, once I get a boyfriend, or once this semester's over, or once I lose 10 pounds, or once this happens, then I'll do something about whatever it is I think I need to do something about. But the only moment I have is right now. Like, this is it. You know, so in Alcoholics Anonymous, I totally believe in the first 164 pages. I totally believe that we have a spiritual awakening. I totally believe. It's not even that I believe. I know, you know, I have experienced it. Not only do I intellectually understand it, I know it experientially. And I know that this program works. And I know that this is not a self-help program. This is a spiritual program. You know, nowhere in the book does it say to me, why don't you sit on down, Stephanie, and think about yourself and your inner child, and you try to work that out right from the very beginning, from the doctor's opinion. It says to me that we must work with another alcoholic, right? We must, or we die. Like, we have to do that. Like, that will certainly save the day. Work with another alcoholic will save the day. And so that's what I've come to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I only have 15 minutes, so I'm like kind of panicking a little here, but we're just going to breathe because God is here. And the thing is that, and this was shocking to me, and I don't think I knew this till I was probably 15 years sober, but God is bigger than even me. Like, God is more powerful than me. Like, that's been a bitter pill to swallow. And there are still parts of my life that I will not turn over, that I'm just kind of like, I will walk on that bridge of faith. I will walk to the edge of that bridge of faith, man. I will walk to the edge of it, and I will throw rocks to the other side, to the shore on the other side, and I will see them land, and I will know that they will land, and I will know based on all of my previous experiences that if I just jump, the distance I have to go is not far at all. I know this, but still I balk. Still I don't jump. You know, and do I not jump because I don't have a good enough spiritual program, because I'm not working a good enough program? No. I used to do that, right? I used to use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as a way to talk about how far I had yet to go, as in order to beat up on myself, in order to catalog my character defects. Not anymore, man. You know, the steps are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And the reason why I continue to have problems, I'm going to blame y'all. The reason why I continue to have problems is, first of all, I'm remarkably human. And that's the best we ever get, is human. But the reason why is if I don't have these experiences and I don't have these memories, I can't identify with you. I can't help you unless I've been there, unless I've done it, unless I've gotten over it, unless I've gotten through it. and done it with God, you know? So, yeah, so I got sober, obviously. God, there's so many good steps. The thing that's coming to my mind, so I'm going to go ahead and say it because that's what I'm supposed to do, is that the book talks about how prayer, meditation, and self-reflection, I always go to 10, 11, and 12 because the daily disciplines are where it's at. If you are feeling unsettled, destabilized, or uncertain about your life, I would ask you one simple question. How are your daily disciplines? The book talks over and over again about how I must be disciplined. I don't have any discipline. Left to my own devices, I'm going to play Fortnite all day long and eat pizza. Neither of those things are productive or good for me. I need discipline. I need discipline. And so the book tells me that prayer, meditation, and self-reflection, when taken separately, can provide much relief. I experienced that for a long time in recovery. I still do, obviously. But when logically interwoven or something like this, they form an unshakable foundation on which we can build our lives, right? I swear to God, I've done this. It actually works. I stop doing it from time to time, and then my house gets a little rickety, but then we just pick it back up because that's what the book says in the 10th step. In the 12 and 12, it says that when we stop these practices, which we invariably will, we simply pray to God for the willingness and then pick it up again as soon as we can. We don't need to beat ourselves up about this. I do not need to beat myself up about this. I have been beating myself up for years. And the book tells me that I need to be happy, joyous, and free. Because if it's attraction rather than promotion, if I sit up here and tell you how many defects I have and how much work I have to do, how attractive is that? But if instead I tell you that despite myself, I have stayed sober and have a life that is second to none and available to all, then maybe that's a little bit more attractive, right? So we got this prayer, meditation, and self-reflection that I have to do every day. And the thing is, I believe that these things are practices, right? I need to practice prayer, practice meditation, practice self-reflection, practice gratitude. And so I have to practice every day. Because if I am going to do what my purpose is, right? My main purpose now is to fit myself to be of maximum service, to help other people, even people I don't like, even people not in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I need to fit myself to be of maximum service. And so I need to be ready to be a spiritual warrior. I think of myself as like this spiritual ninja princess with a tiara, right? And so that is like literally how I envision myself. But I have to practice, because if I just show up to play a sport after not doing anything, I'm going to get my ass handed to me is what's going to happen. But if I have practiced, if I have run sprints and done squats and all of this kind of stuff, then I am going to be physically fit, right? And what they used to talk about all the time when I first got sober is how this disease is physical, mental, and spiritual. And I kind of got on an abstract level that, you know, all recovery is physical, mental, and spiritual too, right? Like physically, I clear up and I clean up. I stop drinking. I stop puking on people. I stop sleeping with other people's people. You know, there are all kinds of good benefits just from putting the drink down. But then emotional sobriety, right? And the book talks about the pains of emotional sobriety and that like spiritual turmoil comes before the pains of emotional sobriety. And I get that. Because pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And for me, I don't see that there's a problem until it's a problem, right? Like I don't learn quickly. And my whole thing is that like, I would love to say that I can learn just from people telling me, but that's not how it works for me. So I have to do these things on the daily. And so what that looks like for me is, and I have to give a shout out to 6 and 7 because 6 and 7, I think are the most, I say about every single step, it's the most important one, but 6 and 7 are really important. And they're really important because like I said, this is a spiritual program, right? So my answer has to come from that God that is deep down inside of me, right? It is there in the last analysis where he may be found. It is only there in the last analysis where he may be found. So I can run around to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, vomit up my problem of the day and get 50 different answers because y'all are nothing if not helpful and get 50 different answers. And then I run myself ragged trying to do all the solutions that you've told me. And I can't understand why I still don't feel happy. And I can't understand why I'm still frustrated. And some girl with 6 months is talking about being happy, joyous, and free, right? At the meeting. I don't get it. Because the answer is in me. God is my solution and God is in me. And so as I've gotten sober and as I've worked these steps, those little nesting dolls have gotten loosened and has gone away. And I have learned how to trust myself, which is something I never even realized, because when I try to be who I think you want me to be, it's because I don't believe in myself enough. It's because when I get into relationships, what I ask is, how am I going to make this work? Not, is this God's will for me? Only once I flipped those things, right? How am I going to keep this, whatever it is? How am I going to get whatever I think I need, as opposed to, is this God's will for me? And so today, 6 and 7 are super important, because 6 and 7 tell me that I don't fix it. I don't work on it. I humbly ask God to remove all these defects of character, or as a friend of mine reminded me this morning, all of these kind of defense mechanisms, all of these ways that I have come to deal with life. Because in my experience, I am really good at survival. I can walk into a room. I know who I need to talk to. I know what I need to say to look good, to get what I want and get out. I have no idea how to live. When my sponsor asked me when I was like 5 years sober, she said to me, Stephanie, what brings you joy? I had no idea. I knew the things that were supposed to make me happy because they made everybody happy. And I said those things. Turns out some of those things don't make me happy. It turns out that I wasn't afraid of being alone. I was afraid of what you all would think of me if I was alone. I'm quite happy alone. And I am never actually alone. I'm just by myself, right? So the prayer, meditation, and self-reflection. The way that it works for me is I have to do them every day. I have to be disciplined. And when taken together in moderation, right? There's never a day when we haven't done something right, the book tells me. And so today when I get up, I ask God to divorce me from self-pity, self-seeking motives, and dishonest motives. And then what I also do, I write this out every morning, and I'm happy to share this with anyone if you want, just email me. But I write those things out, and then I write, what do I want to replace them with? So I want to replace self-pity with courage. I want to replace self-seeking motives with compassion. I want to replace dishonest motives with authenticity, right? And I think those things change, but like that's what came to me right now. And then the book tells me that upon awakening, I consider my day. And so I write out exactly what's going to go on in my day. And in doing that, it shows me that I'm going to be busy later on this afternoon. So I better bring some food with me, or else I'm going to get cranky and be a royal pain in the butt at that meeting. Or it tells me, oh, you have to meet with that sponsee. Don't forget to bring your book, or maybe a little extra prayer is in order. You know, like if I look at my day, I know what's going on with me. And so I don't have to react. I don't have to be so frantic. I don't have to be such a drama queen. I can just go through my day and, like my sponsor says, look for the surprise, right? Look for the surprise. Where is God? Bring God with you. And I really do try to, because if I pretend that God is in my pocket, I behave a lot better. I really, really do. I don't say a lot of the things that are in my head when I'm praying and with God. So I do that. And then I write out my prayer in the mornings, right? I write out my prayer because I think it's cool. It's cool. And I share it with other women. I share that piece of paper. I send a picture of it to a bunch of people. Some people send them back. Some people don't. Some people send me other stuff, like whatever, right? Bill talks about extensively the fact that these 12 steps and this beginning is just a beginning, and that we need to continue to grow and search spiritually. Right? I have to be constantly seeking. When I was drinking and I found out that vodka got me drunk, I didn't stop with just vodka. I tried everything. Why would I not do the same with spiritual practices and sobriety? Right? And I was a total snob about meditation. Recently, I was all like, oh, I do silent meditation. And I do. I love silent meditation. It is the way that I get in touch, the way I get centered, the way I know what my truth is. Because Alcoholics Anonymous has my solution, but only God and I have my answers. And what that looks like is between me and God. And today, I don't always pick right. I don't always pick the healthiest choice. I don't always make the best decisions according to everyone else. But you know what? I can absolutely live with all of my decisions today without any shame or guilt, and remorse or regret, because I did what I thought was best for me at that time, trying to seek and do God's will. How can it be wrong? It can't be, even if I totally whack it up. And I do. I was 20 years sober and I had a guy shooting up heroin in my bathroom with my kids in my house. Yeah, that's not a particularly, you know, poster child for sobriety, but it absolutely positively is, because you know what that is? That's life. That's what happens. And I prayed and all that kind of stuff and got out of it and came through it. And that experience has been insanely useful in working with other women, because I absolutely can use booze, drugs, sex, shoes, pound cake, Oreos, working out, and ladies and gentlemen, Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship as a way to avoid what is actually going on and what is actually God's will. Because the bottom line is that God wants absolutely, positively, amazing, remarkable, abundant, unlimited things for me. And for everyone, I believe, like ridiculously huge and good, ridiculously. And that terrifies me, because I'm afraid I can't live up to it. I won't be good enough. Who will I be? People will think I'm being a snob. People won't like me. I have all of those regular fears, but no matter how much I'm afraid of it, kicking and screaming, I gotta go. It's God's will. So I have to find a way to step into the abundance and glory that is God's will for me. And that is terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, but it is also inevitable, you know? And that's why I have to do that meditation, because that truth is in me. And so I try to live that truth. And I do that prayer, like I talk about in the mornings, and I do self-reflection at some point. I don't do, and I know I only have 2 minutes and 41 seconds. I don't do big, huge 10 steps every single day. I think part of that's also because I'm not in a romantic relationship where many of my crazies have a tendency to manifest themselves. But I do inventory regularly. I'm going like 3 times a week lately, and that seems to be good. Because if I look at self-reflection too much, if I focus too much on inventory, I got to write inventory, I got to do some columns. And don't get me wrong, inventory is crucial. The columns are important, and the columns are very clearly described in the book. If you're questioning what the columns are, call me. But if I focus too much on inventory, then I'm not here. I'm not joyous. I'm not living in God's life, world. I'm not doing what it is I'm supposed to do, because what I'm not supposed to do is color code and index my freaking defects. What I'm supposed to do is be helpful to someone, a newcomer. You know, like, it's not important. I'm 28 years sober. Like, you know, just the fact that my feelings were hurt at work yesterday, you know, sure, it's important. It needs to be dealt with. Like, you know, I have to deal with my stuff. Is it way more important that there's probably someone in this meeting who feels guilt and shame about her past sex conduct that I can sit here and be like, yeah, I was promiscuous too. I banged out virtually everything. Can I say that in a meeting? Absolutely. And do I do it so that someone might not feel shame? Every single day, every single day. Because what I have been given is a gift beyond my wildest dreams, and I haven't even scratched the surface. We will be amazed before we are halfway through. I'm amazed, you know? So anyway, I was freaking all over the place, but whatever, you get it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous works. God is the center of it all. And as a result of all of that, you know, the biggest thing is I don't want to be anyone else today. I'm not jealous of other women today. I don't covet other people's stuff or people today. And I'm enough. I know in the core of my being that I am enough. And that's what I always wanted. So thank you very much for having me. And that's it.